Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookshop, Wellington Square. Today, our guest is Atish Tahzir. His new novel is The Way Things Were, published just last month by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Prior to that, and going way back, Atish published Manto, which was his selected short stories, then Stranger to History, which was part memoir, part travelogue, if you will. Then, I guess that's his only nonfiction work. Then his next novel was The Temple Goers, and then, before The Way Things Were, was Noon, another tale about a fissure stratification between cultures. All these books, all of them, carry with them a portmanteau of language, very important, of nationality, of confusion regarding a place in the world as a citizen with regard to culture and what is my culture, loyalties to a nation and to a history. And this book, I would like to say, if I was thinking about it in terms of, it's so intensely involved with language, in this case Sanskrit and the cognate, I would call it something like reconstructing the Tower of Babel. And so here's the deal. If you like or love cognates, Indo-European roots, and a litany of derivative words throughout and crossing centuries and countries, then this is the book for you. If you don't know what a cognate is, like, say, George Bush, Donald Trump, or Ted Cruz, pretty much all Republicans except maybe Ron Paul, then you might not like the book so much. So our dual cast begins with Toby, a father who cuts out of whole cloth his son, Skanda. Toby dies. Skanda returns to India. Skanda's mother, Uma, which is great because I love Uma Thurman, and finally I know what Uma means, and his sister do not return with him for the cremation and funeral. So as usual, I go on and on with my introductions. But this is supposed to be an interview, so welcome, Atish, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam. That was a wonderful introduction.
Thanks. I love the book, and it was like I was saying, I mean, to me, going through it, and because I love language as well, and the derivation of words, and the fact that it's always fascinating that our world is composed of countries that actually share a common heritage in language. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me. It's almost like you lay.
Right.
It's, yeah. So I'm doing it again. Tell us a little, because most of the listeners haven't read your book yet, why don't you tell us a little bit about it and how it came to be?
Well, let's just stay with the theme of language, because I like the way you spoke of it so much. Someone had described it to me very early on after reading the book. They said, you know, it plays almost the role of a chorus or like a kind of central metaphor. And there was very much this sense that here, like I think Toby even says it at one point, he says that except for the material from which we're made, this is like our deepest affinity, this shared history of sound and meaning. And then as nations evolve, as the Tower of Babel shatters, so to speak, into different languages, people like invest these words, these sounds, with politics, with history, with identity. And so because the book is set in a period of such turmoil where people are kind of resorting to all kinds of tribalism, there's always this, the language and that old history of Proto-Indo-European sound kind of is always there as a sort of almost a kind of vision of an underlying unity. And so it's a metaphor that kind of looks in on itself endlessly, but it was something that I remember like very much writing out of the passion of this incredible history.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know why I thought this, but when you talk about a metaphor looking in on itself endlessly, look, this is a book, it's a realistic book. It's like this actually happened. These people were here and they had these relationships and went here and there. But I just had this feeling of magical realism. I didn't know why. And then you wait until page 155 until you begin to talk about metafiction.
Yeah, but metafiction is different from magical realism. There's what I think you're picking up on, which there absolutely is there's a very self-conscious idea of authorship. In fact, even with the what exactly is happening, Iskander telling this story, it doesn't quite appear to be that way. He's not like the narrator, for instance, of The Great Gatsby. He doesn't go home and write the book. And yet, you feel that he arrives, there's this kind of paralysis in Delhi, and he needs in some ways to deal with his past, to have his past kind of wash over him. And you have these dual narratives, which is something that I borrowed actually from the Sanskrit epic poetry of the 4th century, this idea of a dual narrative. And the two narratives are kind of aware of each other, and yet it's never explicit. It's sort of gestured to. So there is that kind of quality that's vaguely magical, but at the same time there's a very powerful, I mean, there's certainly like nothing of Marquez and Rushdie in this book.
No, but you know, it's like when you're listening to a piece on sitar, there's always the woman who's in the back who's the drone.
And yeah, the tampura.
Yeah, and it's almost as if there is that, it doesn't stop. It's always there. And you know, it's funny, what I was going to say is there are no chapters as such. There's parts, and it's a challenge to the reader because you're dealing with father and son, and you end one page, and the next page you're dealing with the son, and maybe three pages later you're dealing with the father, but you don't tell us that that's what you're doing.
No, but I think that very quickly you become, because there's...
You do.
Remember, on the surface, on the narrative in the present, almost nothing happens. A man arrives, he waits, he visits his family, he meets his mother, and he immerses the ashes. It's the thinnest narrative possible. It's almost a kind of stagnant, and yet you feel the kind of flood of years underneath. And so, if you start to read, you suddenly become aware that little things have carried over from one narrative into the other. And so I think that quite soon, even though like there might be initially the feeling of being adrift, very quickly you become aware of design, you know, and then you know that actually there is some kind of hand guiding you in some direction, and you know, and I don't know, a reader starts to be able to navigate his way quite easily, don't you think?
Well, that's one of my most important points about this book, is questioning who your audience is, because Indians know a lot about America, and you know a lot about both countries, and you've traveled the world, and you have a multicultural background. Americans are kind of dumb, and they don't know anything about India.
It's not true, Sam, by the way. Like, I've had an extraordinary receptive my American reviews have been dazzling. They've been in many ways more sophisticated than my Indian reviews.
Oh, I agree 100% with that. But then if you go there, if there's a paragraph of Sanskrit, or you're talking about a book or a myth, that Americans, I don't know. There is an audience. Who is the audience? You tell me.
Well, it's impossible for a writer like me. I feel like very much like a writer kind of in a state of some kind of exile. And there is no assumed knowledge. I don't think that even within countries we can assume knowledge anymore. But for somebody like me who's coming out of some kind of post-colonial context, cobbling together a readership of people in India, perhaps in England and America, there's no way for me to write to an audience, so to speak. But at the same time, as much as you're right, Indians know tremendous about America, you feel that that we do have this strange, floating, kind of educated audience that is able to pick up on books that come from very far afield. And if the book has big themes, in this case, history, the weight of the past on the individual, you feel the book will find its way, but I personally don't ever write with any kind of readership in mind. I don't even think I could imagine it if I tried.
I can. Your books need to be read by people who want to learn. I think if you, well, like you said about the narrative, if you don't want to learn. It's like when Toby would give Skanda those pop quizzes, you know? It's like you kind of are doing that to your readers. You're kind of saying, okay, here's this, and these are the words. Yeah. And now, okay, reader, now remember that. And it's kind of cool because you kind of do learn it.
Well, this is a nice thing because actually the didactic quality is something that's like, it's not something that's external to the narrative. It's actually part of the narrative. There's a constant theme of receiving and imparting knowledge, of learning, of the transmission of knowledge. So it's kind of like, it sort of worked in there. And I think that I probably would have had to do that because none of this is familiar to anybody. You know, this is special knowledge. And I did want people coming in to not, for the Sanskrit to not be distancing, to actually, for people to get excited about it after a while, even though in the beginning you might sort of think like, oh my God, how am I expected to get on with this?
I did feel that at first. And then I kind of felt relieved, like I wasn't such a jackass when you say about Uma, that after all this talk between Skanda and his colleague, that Uma says she only had the vaguest impression of the terrain.
And well, that's it. So you have allies within the narrative who are just as fed up as you are.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
obsession with language.
And what about okay, Uma? You know, she has the vaguest. What about me? And, you know, it's like if she, then how can I? But the thing about it is, it's like, in my life, if I can envision a sleeping, dreaming God who's dreaming the universe, and that's where we are, I mean, that's the reader you want, I think, because that gives him access to what you're writing about, I think.
Yeah, and also, like, from my own experience, I was thinking of certain novels in which I was a little adrift, novels, for instance, about music, which I know nothing about, and it's surprising how, like, after a while, especially with the kind of resources available to us today, it becomes kind of fun. I suppose there has to be a little bit of a spirit of learning, as you said, but I like it. I like also being a little bit out of my depth, you know, as a reader.
It's even true in the way you use the English language when you say, like, carbuncular headlights. No one, you know, I think it's like Nabokov. I thought he was one of the best writers because English was his second language. And so if you say carbuncular headlights, or in the motorcycle, sitting pillion, it's like you have this.
The carbuncular headlight is an imaginative usage. I mean, I've invented that, but the sitting pillion is something that I think maybe just more like antiquated English.
Exactly.
In India, we still have a lot of Victorian English. So people always say about someone having children, they say, oh, he has two issue, you know?
Right.
And so you still use language in funny ways. And so some of that's kind of crept in from the kind of English that's still around in India. But the carbuncular headlights is the light is imaginative usage.
I know. It's like the word actinic. You seldom hear it, but when you hear it, you know exactly what it means. And... there's so many points I could make, I'm not making the points, wait a minute, you are. But the one section where you talk about, this is so current, the voice of prejudice, you know, bold, original, the power to subdue, to drown out others, that's Donald Trump the past 2 weeks. He's number one in the polls, and it's all because of what exactly that. Isn't that strange?
Right. And exactly in the way it plays out in the same way, like a society gathers together it comes to a certain place. Certain standards become acceptable. And perhaps there are excesses, like with political correctness, we think, we've gone too far in one direction. But the man who comes initially to kind of tear up the society and say exactly what everyone is really thinking, you know? Well, he's also appealing to your worst nature, and for a while, it's very seductive, you know. And people are like, "Oh yes, of course, this is why everything is wrong. It's only because these are the real truths, and people are not willing to say them." And then it takes. I mean, I feel like in a society like this one, a man like that will eventually be found out. You know, he won't go as far as he thinks he's going to go. But as you know from history, there are societies in which people like that have gone very far.
Correct.
Based on that kind of, but even then, after a while, they have to usually put together a kind of apparatus that that keeps out the person who questions him. You know what I mean? It becomes like a because it's not a universal truth when you're like governed by prejudice or bigotry. It's very short-lived.
Well, not to be totally politically incorrect, but if you're talking like a Reich-like atmosphere, I tested it on myself. When he said we should build a wall between Mexico and the United States, I thought to myself, well, let's see. If bad people are coming over, we could build a fence, and then you wouldn't need the border patrol, and it would put a lot of people to work, and there should be a process by which people come in who are nice, and the bad people shouldn't come in, so we should have a fence. And I'm going through this in my own mind, thinking, well, maybe he has a point. And then I go, no, you idiot. Go back to being fair and nice and, you know, bring me your tired, your poor. But it's, you know.
And especially in a country like this where you've thrived so much on a tradition of vitality, of people coming in, being absorbed, of the culture being richer as a result of it, like, it would be a terrible thing to just come into that business of purity, of building walls. It's such a primitive idea, you know?
Well, translate that for me. Look at India, which was the third largest democracy, or will soon be a superpower, has its own nuclear arsenal, is, you know, moving along amazingly quickly in terms of technology and information. So how is it, and I know you talk about it in the book, but how are you so different than us, and what will that mean in 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, you know, in India, it's sort of like all the ages have come at once. I mean, there are parts of India where you feel like an unbroken tradition of 2,000 years. I remember the writer Ruth Prior Jabwara saying, you know, it was like living in biblical times, and there is that sense of beggars, of lepers, of I was in a village in Bihar where there was still there were these people who kill mice and eat them. And it was a community of people desperately poor. And then on the other side, you have these sort of like what the economist Amartya Sen calls these little islands of California.
Yeah.
You know, like spread out across India. And those are real and part of a kind of emerging reality. So in India, I think what's going to be tremendously important is to thread all this together, to in some ways, not just economically, but even culturally, to find some way in which people are able to make a whole of what is at the moment like very fragmented experience.
On another tangent, it's really funny. I didn't really think about Skanda's name until I realized that the painting and the peacocks are what gave rise to his name.
Wow, you've read this so well. I'm so moved by your attention.
Well, I guess it must be a good book then, because it's hard to read. But so I have always had peacocks, and so now I have a white one and a blue one. But the thing about it is that they don't like me. They don't like me, and they're smarter than me.
The peacocks.
Oh yeah. And, you know, I never realized.
Where do you keep these peacocks?
they live in Philadelphia. I'm in Philadelphia. The winter sometimes is -4 degrees. They don't care. I've never fed them. I've never fed them once.
I think you're just pulling the leg of a visitor to your country. You're
no.
Ridiculing me on your show by telling me this outlandish story.
I wouldn't do that, but would it kind of cool if I did? But this is the truth. I had one peacock that he despised me. He despised my dog. And
yeah, they're a little bit like camels in that way. No? They're kind of misanthropic.
It's like, what can you do for me? And
and they're also very vain.
Oh yeah.
In the Sanskrit poems, they're always described their vanity. And even in English, I like that when we talk about a group of peacocks, we say an ostentation of peacocks.
Right. But the thing, it's my I am very unfair to them because it's very hard to find peahens in America unless you get them shipped to you as chicks, and that's really hard to raise. So they don't have peahens, so they I have chickens. So they attempt to impress the chickens by displaying to them, but the chickens are like, you know, what? What are you doing?
And do they dance when it rains?
Yeah. Yeah. And now their feathers are everywhere, and I take each of their feathers and I put it in a pot full of dirt, and then my children friend and my children, they love the feathers, so I hand them out in little bunches, and they're fascinating creatures. And
In Sanskrit poetry, one is very nice. It's a great trope because they represent the coming of the rains, and in a hot country after a terrible summer, the rains represent kind of fertility and a sort of renewal in some ways. And when the rains go, the peacocks flourish in the rain, especially the male peacocks. But when the rains have are finished, they fall into a kind of depression. And the Sanskrit poets describe them as with a compound. It's like being robbed of festivity. They suddenly like fall to contemplation, you know, as if like they've there's a real sense of like the party being over. And so
once again, I'll just keep. I always like write things down in circles, and then I have lines going off the circles and stuff like that. That's why I keep switching. But the sex.
Yeah.
The sex in your book is really well written and graphic in a sense, but it's like it comes at things kind of on a strange angle. Different. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Like when, the first night with Uma and Toby.
Yeah.
When he is waiting for this release and she releases him, but in an unusual way.
She puts his finger in his.
Yeah, that's a family show. So anyway.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
But the producer will yell at
me. This is, I mean, I don't know if, maybe if for a family show perhaps, but I mean, this is, you know, we don't want to make anything, there's nothing unclean about sex.
No.
It's a good thing.
But what I'm saying is that concept, and this is what you do throughout the book. Everything is metaphor, and the fact that he's looking for something that he doesn't know how to find it, but she does, and this is why they so fall so madly. That moment when he goes into the restroom and there she is, and it's like, and I've had that experience too, where it's completely natural, and but what I guess what I'm getting at is. I haven't read, to be honest, I haven't read another book in which those kinds of scenes, explicit as they are, carry a different kind of message along. You have these packets of information that travel along with other packets, and I've heard you talk about that in interviews. Basically, the dualistic, all of your writing. And where did that, how was that born? Because of the culture of your country?
No, I feel, let's just stay on the subject of sex for a moment longer. I think that sex, especially in novels, ought to be invested with something. I mean, it should have a kind of, it should contain a tension other than just the sex. And sex often does. I mean, it often does like become imbued with the kind of the feelings of a relationship or whatever. And I think that in this book, especially from that very first moment where there is this kind of little act of power and of release and later, you know, like there's a very, when they're partying, you know, you can feel that their sex has got very bad in the middle, you know, and when they're partying and you can see this kind of cold, wintry anger that Toby has towards Uma. They finally have sex, and it's good as it's never been before, you know. So a certain, like, I think a certain attention to that way that sex carries these other tensions, that is important to me. So that's very real. Tell me what you were saying about the dualism again. I didn't completely follow you.
Well, it's because I wish I could remember what you were having an interview with an Indian woman. I've forgotten the name of the show, but it had two parts on YouTube. She said she called the book "The Way We Were," and you kind of said, "No, it's not the way we were." And I was thinking,
I know that song, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's your own fault for naming it that way.
Nemesis, yeah, exactly.
So she got it wrong, and then she said you wrote three books, and you went, "No, I wrote four books." And she goes, "Oh, four, whatever."
Yeah, I remember that.
So in that interview, you were talking about, she was talking about duality, and. Mm. It's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around the concept to explain it properly. But, well, obviously there's duality because you have Skanda and Toby, and there's, you can compare and contrast. But you also have duality because, I mean, here I am, an American, reading a paragraph in Sanskrit that I can't understand. But I can understand, for example, when you say, "By the clock 'tis day, and yet dark night strangles the traveling lamp." So you're quoting
Macbeth.
Yeah, you're quoting Macbeth in this horrible crime that Macbeth has committed, and it's created a kind of supernatural world. And your world, the world of your book, has this supernatural quality to it because a lot of the plot, thin as you say it is driven by a language that's essentially dead to most of the country.
Right.
And so so that's the way I'm looking at it, two things. That's my two things.
Yeah. I think that, like, I mean, remember that also, like, for me, I wouldn't have been working in that schematic sense, in the sense I wouldn't have had all these ideas and concepts first. Like, I would have had people, and I had Uma and Skanda and Toby pretty early on, and then the kind of the novel, like, it grew out of these things, and I knew that this language that couldn't, would always be there as a kind of underlying fabric that would, I always sort of thought like that would play a role, but I think my way of working was probably much more instinctive, and so So when you ask me a question like that, it kind of stumps me, because I don't know how to do it the other way. You know, it's, I think probably in that respect, you're probably better positioned to understand these things and to pick up on them than I am.
That's kind of the answer you gave her, actually, because she asked you this. I thought it was a silly question about, do you storyboard your novel? She said. And I'm thinking, you know, what kind of question is that? This is not a cinematic. This is not a movie. You don't storyboard a novel and, you know, take pushpins and put them up on a corkboard. Or maybe some people do, I don't know. But it just didn't seem right for the purposes of this book. But one interesting thing was, there's this, the ebb and flow of power, both in Toby and Uma, and in Skanda, and what's his girlfriend's name?
Gori.
There's eventual realization of passivity in the two men. And sometimes you denigrate Toby, again, almost as a peacock, in terms of vanity and a showpiece for people to invite to parties, and then they can pretend they're Indian. And I wondered how that came about in your head. Why did you turn the male protagonists?
Because I you know, the line that the brigadier says, he says, "Don't ever forget that in certain places, a kind of fineness of feeling is synonymous with weakness."
Yes.
And I wanted, like, very much this idea of this man who has a really beautiful vision of classical India, that in some ways it gets in the way of him seeing his place clearly. And Toby is always under threat. You fear for him. He's vulnerable in a way that that kind of unnerves you right from the beginning, and certainly unnerves Uma. And so, it's not for me to say, you know, these related characters have relationships with each other, and it's not for me to say that, is Toby pathologically passive, or is he kind of wonderful? I mean, I would want the reader to carry both those ideas in their head. But certainly when he's with Uma, or in certain environments that are quite rough, then we should feel his passivity. We should feel the way he withdraws in the face of a confrontation. We should feel that he doesn't have the right language to deal with the roughness of his place. So that's those are not final judgments, but those are part of the many judgments that the reader would want to have about a character. And I think it's probably what makes a character complex, is that all those things could be said about him.
Which was interesting at one particular point when Toby gets up on the table at the end of a kind of raucous evening and makes his offer of, I don't want to do any spoilers, but he makes his offer that he'll pay this amount of money if somebody does a specific act. And that, at first I thought that's kind of gratuitous. You know, it doesn't seem like he would say it. Is he just drunk and that's it? But then it kind of resonated with me throughout the novel. I'm wondering, what was he attempting to accomplish by doing that? What was it? Do you know?
Well, so, you know, for one, when you meet him, he is kind of wonderful, and the novel is, in a way, the story of his diminishing. So it's a certain kind of youth. It's an exuberance. He is a little drunk. And he can also be, I mean, he's not by no means, He can become subdued, but he's full of a kind of euphoria for life, for even with the project that he does with the Sanskrit books and things like that. He's not a non-actor. And in that moment, like, I think he is capable of a gesture which has a kind of flamboyance in it. And at the same time, you might think, oh, is this man a bit of a fool? And, you know, again, there's like it's like even when he wants to leave India for good in the end of the novel, he leaves with a certain kind of grace, and that aesthetic quality that Toby has to the way that he views his life, to the way that he thought of Uma and them together, like that never leaves us, and it's sort of always part of Toby, and it stands in very sharp contrast to Mani Raja, who has no aesthetic idea of life. You know, his idea of life is purely political. Everything can be reduced to politics. Do you stand on this side of the line? Are you Republican or are you Democrat? That's all I need to know about you. Now you can go home. You know, like that kind of textured quality just doesn't exist for him. And so, so Toby and Mani Raja, in those ways, like, it's one of the most profound things that sets them apart from each other.
You have to. To have that textured quality to your life, again, it's like coming to your book. You have to have this. The way I look at life is that you're here for one purpose, and that's to gather as much information as you can. I mean, why would be human if you weren't doing that? You wouldn't be human because you have the ability to gather information and process it. For example, so in a book, generally, whether it's War and Peace or Anna Karenina, or Crime and Punishment, there's this overarching theme, and you can follow it along, but there's these things that happen. And it's not just raising an axe to kill somebody. So, like, for example, after Toby's lecture, when Uma hears him for the first time, when she goes up and invites him to, what's the guy's name's house?
To Baba's house.
Yeah. She puts her hand, she grasps his hand, which to me was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then during the roundup, when they were having the rotten, I'm sorry, I'm missing it. What did you call them when they would roust somebody out, and when they would arrest people, and during the emergency.
Yeah. They were the midnight arrests when they were arresting the opposition.
Yeah, and when Toby goes through the headquarters and the guy who's obviously just a pawn, and he doesn't really say anything, and Uma grabs him by the shirt and says, "What the?" She's basically saying, "Why don't you just be a man? You know, man up."
Oh, during the tax raid.
Yeah, the raid, the raids.
Yeah.
And that's the first time you realize, you know what? She's the one that's wearing the pants in this family, not him.
And
she was not afraid.
Yeah.
And she's not afraid at the beginning of the book after when Toby dies.
You know, no, she's not. In fact, that emergency period is meant to, where you really realize. And I had very much this idea in my head that the pattern of a relationship actually gets set very quickly. And as much as I want you to feel a certain feeling of pity throughout the book for the end of this relationship, you should also have very little doubt that there's a kind of thread of doom running through the relationship right at the beginning.
You do.
And it is to do with power. It is to do with the fact that, you know, in the end, what she opts for is someone who is more virile, who represents strength in cruder ways, and Toby is found in that certain environment to be too weak to survive. And so these things were very real to me, and this, I suppose, was also it was real to my experience of India, which could be like that. It could, you know, there'd been a great tradition of Indians kind of forcing out people of talent, of sensibility, and they would often have to go to other places to actually realize their capacities, and sometimes they would then come back and be feted in India. But India can be very brutal in that way.
Yeah, it's when you're talking about Uma and the idea of not, I guess you say brutality, but I think that's too strong a word. What was the name when they made their first trip, when they left in part because of what he said, and they left and they met his colleague who they had that semi-hate, love-hate relationship. What's that gentleman's name?
With Vijay Pal.
Yes. So when they're looking at the statues and Uma's there behind him, no, in front of him, she's mm-hmm. there in front of him, and she, like a man, goes through her head, well, he's not attractive physically, mm-hmm. but there's something about this moment, and she can make it happen. And
yeah.
she turns, smiles, and she sees this acknowledgement on his part, but also a slight bitterness too, and then he attacks Toby.
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting point too. I always wondered, you must have thought about, because that was a very, you know, that's a cinematic scene, isn't it?
It is. It's another way, I think, in which, like, sort of sexual power stands in for other kinds of power, you know? So here's this moment where this man is, you feel as he could make a pass, he could make a pass at her, she could actually respond. And then the moment's lost, and she's kind of like, suddenly, you know, that way that you can sometimes feel very virtuous when you actually haven't been all that virtuous, but you suddenly, the thing has passed and you feel suddenly, and so he wants to, on one hand, call her out on that, and on the other, like, he's seeing Toby through certain eyes, and he's the first man to spoil this for her, you know? He's the first man to plant this little idea in her head that this is really not someone she could be with. And kind of a horrible thing to do in some ways.
Well,
but,
it's kind of funny, though, in a sense. It was, actually, I kind of laughed when I read that scene, because instead of him calling her out, he calls Toby out big time. And when she decides she's not going to do it, she goes, well, you know, I just started up this one thing. You really shouldn't do it if you just started up one thing where you're really hot. You know, it's like part of her reasoning was, it just doesn't seem right to do it when I'm really excited about being with this one guy.
Yeah. But it's very like, I mean, it's much more powerful in some ways, because if he was to have attacked her, it would have been very transparent, but to run down the person who she's, and right at in the beginning of their love, to kind of plant this seed of doubt, it's quite an effective, malicious thing to do.
Oh, yeah, he was a pain in the, No, I agree. One of the things that is interesting, and it happens in English as well, is when you talk about the hour of juncture between day and night.
Sandhya.
And I was thinking, you know, when early on in the book, you also talk about, you make an analogy to the Eskimos, whatever, 114 words for snow.
And right.
So I think, you know, in America, you have twilight, you have dusk, you have the gloaming, which I love that word.
Mm, I love that word too.
And you have sunset and evening, but I don't know the difference between them. I don't know the difference between twilight, dusk, and gloaming. And that kind of, all I thought of that, and that kind of resonated with me with regard to your sometimes these trails of words. And,
yeah.
And how they work their way, again, like I said, through countries, through time, through place.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, I think, like the effect of classical literature on the novel, because the in the most enchanting way, the Sanskrit poets are in love with the natural world. And so their concern for naming animals or like the different kind of flowers or the seasons or that kind of thing is so overdone almost. You know, it's part of the most ornate side of the poetry. And so there is this little kind of echo of classical writing as with regard to the natural world in the novel, which I find in you know, when Kotzer says, you know, there is no mere landscape. Someone was interviewing him, he says, is this mere landscape? He says, there is no mere landscape. You know, this for me was the landscape that really kind of had entered my soul. And so North India there's a lot of attention to the physicality, to the landscape. And as far as the, we don't have twilight in that way, because there's what I think Naipaul would describe as the suddenness of night, you know, in these places where it's in the north, there's a little bit more of that kind of lingering light, but especially as you're in the south, it's suddenly dark, you know, and it's not drawn out. So in fact, I think when they're in Bangalore, there is a little scene like that, and then there are kind of big leaved trees,
right.
And there's this kind of moist night that comes very fast. So I guess I was alive to that kind of thing.
But it's funny, because when we go back to the Macbeth quote and you talk about daytime darkness, and I guess is the word, is it Nabhas? The word.
Oh, yeah.
But then you go...
mist, which is related to nebulous.
Right.
And to yeah.
Yeah, when you go through that litany, and I was amazed, I was thinking, oh, nebula. Okay, I know what a nebula is. So that gives me the opportunity to know what this daytime darkness is, which is related to a classical British English playwright. You know, you're doing something different here, and you have in your other books too. It's just something ineluctable that I can't explain, nor can I ask you the right question, but it's definitely something different. And I don't know if it's because you straddle these cultures or not.
You know, straddling, and also, like, remember, this is a book about making a whole of the past in some ways of threading together history, and that's a constant theme. And in my own life as a writer, I was very aware of a fractured past. As much as it seems to you like a kind of cosmopolitanism, like in India, it's very confusing because we grow up in such a way where we're kind of completely set apart from the people we live in, with language and with sort of, like, you know, she says, like, oh, it was all kind of Jane Austen and Shakespeare and Wordsworth, and all the Indian writing was completely ignored. So for me at least, like a huge sense of personal discovery. And it was in a very simple way, which was that here I am in this given region trying to be a writer, and there were writers before me in this very same area, and all my education has been kind of designed to steer me away from these people. And how is it that I don't even know what they were up to, you know? And so when not only did I make a kind of personal discovery of first Urdu and then Sanskrit and this thing, and there was a kind of glory about what I've been missing out on, the book, I think, like, definitely it tries to kind of, like, it does try to piece together. There is a kind of feeling of bringing a literary whole, you know, of like of having Kalidas on one side and on Shakespeare on the other. And I suppose it's sort of that sense that that kind of that if one thing is not shut out, then the world is actually very rich in its hybrids. You know, if India was to take its whole literary inheritance, it would be a very rich inheritance. But if it becomes to the exclusion of you know something else, then you end up in more trouble than you want to be in. You know,
it's a confusing world. You know, it's like about like the attitude towards Sanskrit, and then when she says, "I wandered lonely as a cloud," it's like she's making a joke. She's being condescending to Toby.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that is classic, but she's treating it as if it's, you know, like just...
Well, because the question even of like, which comes up in America sometimes, like, you know, like what are the classics? What are the classics for a place like India? Like, you know, like there's that boarding school where he's like, you know, like we don't want children coming here. They're paying good money. We want them to be learning Shakespeare, not some kind of local junk or whatever. And Toby's like thinking to himself, he's like, well, you know, what, or it's IP, I think, who says like, 1 minute. So the English were here, their now English power is out. So what, like in 50 years, are our classics going to be Mark Twain and Emerson and Melville? I mean, are we going to constantly remake ourselves in the image of whatever power is ascendant? So that relationship, I think, between like cultural power and what we consider to be the classics, you know? I remember a very striking moment in Catherine Boo's book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, where there's a girl in a slum who's reading Virginia Woolf. And you think, and it's just a completely absurd thing, but it's a very real part of what it means to be colonized, because, you know, you wouldn't, it would be like, your own stuff is considered sort of like déclassé, you wouldn't touch it, but you think it's tremendously important for a girl in a Bombay slum to read Virginia Woolf. So that comes, I think, from quite a real lived experience of these confusions, so to speak.
In America, there's kind of a homogenous vernacular, but there isn't any in India, because you're not homogenized, correct? Is there a vernacular? There is no vernacular.
No, there's... I mean, the linguistic confusions are amazing. There's always been, like, different forms, like high languages, Sanskrit, Persian, now English, that kind of stitch together this broad landmass. And then within that sphere, there are different... Everyone has their own different languages. And then many people have completely different dialects. And so it's linguistically a very wide range that's always kind of complicated things. But what's been nice is that India has always philosophically understood this idea of the one and the many. And so there's on one hand this kind of, it used to be quite a gentle overarching idea of an Indian wholeness, and at the same time, tremendous variety within that. A little bit like Europe, I would say, probably like very similar to the European experience.
Yeah, I guess I can see that now. I understand what you're saying. But, you know, you couldn't do it. But if you're writing a book like this, which is kind of like explaining a world, it's almost as if you're trying to be James Joyce writing Finnegan's Wake, which is impossible.
I would really be setting myself up for disaster, you know. But you're being unfair to me, because I'm not sitting down to write the book. I've already written the book.
I know, but look, Finnegan's Wake is a book more about language than any book ever written. That's why you can pick it up and start reading it at any spot in the book and still not know what you're talking about. I understand you wrote the book and it's done, but what I'm saying is you have devoted your career as an author to loving language.
Which is not unreasonable, considering it's the medium I work in.
I was going to say, don't. I was going to say, don't be so defensive.
not the strangest thing in a world in the world for a writer to be devoted to language.
I guess that's true. I guess that's why I have a bookstore. All right, I'll let that one go. That was a mistake. Well, okay. With that, I think we're pretty much exhausted the topic. Books are about words. Well, anyway, yes, yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I love the book. It's hard to say it wasn't an easy read, because that always sounds bad.
Well, I don't want you to put anyone off.
A lot of people
have seemed to, especially in America, seem to have done very well with it. I mean, even the People magazine was recommending it to people as a beach read, and when I looked on Amazon, one of the things that were like bought along with it were like a little pair of like lilac flip flops, and so I wanted very much to stay in that spirit for a while, and for it not to like be sort of banished into that realm of literary fiction so that no one will read it.
Well, I don't care. It's not a beach read. I don't care if you get mad at me.
I know people who take Proust to the beach.
Well, they can read about the Madelines. That part's good. Then they can go home and get lunch. But anyway, the book is on our front table. So I am selling it and I am pushing it. And I will even more so now, because this interview has given me a greater understanding of it. And
well, it's been lovely to talk to you, and thank you for reading it so well.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure to do so. Atish Tasir, a spirited, lively, cordial conversation about a book that, okay, if he wants to say it's an easy read, that's fine. And it is an easy read in the sense that you dive into something that you think is hard, like say Moby Dick or I don't know, something by Faulkner, but there's so much that you get out of it. And as I was saying to him, there's so much that you learn. And what could be better than to read a book that you enjoy, but at the conclusion of which you find that you've gained a certain understanding of something that you had none before. And my knowledge of Indian mythology, religion, language was essentially de minimis before I began this book. And as I go through it, and as Atish said, the plot is a thin plot, but the plot moves you along, and it moves you through this lovingly portrayed homage to language, the fact that we have a common heritage, and the fact that all of the words we use, other countries and other languages use the same root, which, as I said at the beginning, is almost as if the book was devoted to a reconstruction of the Tower of Babel, not in the sense of an affront to God, but in the sense of creating a whole mankind, one that allows people everywhere to understand what the person they're communicating with is saying, and to provide, as Atish said, a textured life, one in which you're not Republican or Democrat, one in which you can communicate with other people in such a fashion that you have the ability to understand the layering of their life. And I think that's something that would be wonderful. So in any event, I really enjoyed the interview. I really enjoyed the book. I highly recommend it. And maybe why I said it wasn't an easy read, it's because it's so different from the books, most of the books that I review and the authors that I interview. So it was a pleasure talking to him. And as always, thank you for joining us. We have a bunch of people lined up in the coming weeks. We're, you know, going to be the end of summer. My daughters are going back to school. I don't know how it's the end of summer. And then a lot of these books are coming out. Of course, there's the summer books, and then there's books that come out in September. And so we should have a load of authors. Rebecca is working assiduously on gathering together a whole bunch of them. I will be at Authors Night in the Hamptons on August 8th, and I'll get to meet a lot of authors there, including my companion, which is wonderful, Christina Baker Klein, the author of The Orphan Train, who will be accompanying me to the Hamptons, which is like so incredibly cool for me. And in any event, I'm excited about the coming, I don't know, school year and our school year in terms of, meeting authors, learning about books, and gathering information that we can use to enlighten our lives and to entertain us while we're doing so. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader.